Hey, my name's Emma.
Hey, my name's Maddie.
And you're listening to The Pilots Pandemic.
Hey guys, before we get into this week's episode, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a safety advisory. This is a trigger warning. Some of the language or content used in this week's episode may be found as disturbing or harmful to one's self, aka triggering. Be advised and please proceed with caution.
Hey y'all, welcome back to this week's episode of the Pilots Pandemic Podcast. You're here with your host Emma and our lovely co-host Maddie.
Hey guys.
And this week we have the honor and privilege of being joined by our guest Anne Suh. Anne, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Hi everyone. I'm Anne Suh. I'm glad to be here today. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is an episode that we've been long awaiting to share with our audience. John's story, his legacy, has had just a major butterfly effect on mental health in the aviation space. So today we wanted to have Anne on to share her story, her son's story, and also we just want to start by learning more about you, Anne. So if you don't mind, tell us what you do for work and what are your hobbies?
Sure. I'm an internal medicine physician, which is similar to being a primary care physician. And I work here in Chicago and I am with a hospital called Northwestern. So it's in the city of Chicago. It's busy right now since you guys have heard of the pandemic, I'm sure. And it's been a busy last couple of years with our practice and the hospital's been busy. It's been kind of a stressful time, actually, as everybody I'm sure could agree with. And in terms of hobbies outside of work, I love spending time with animals, especially our dog, our crazy dog, Chloe, who's almost 11. It acts like a puppy and taking her out for walks. We haven't been doing it lately, but we enjoy traveling. And in particular, we like traveling to places where we can do things outside, like hiking, biking, camping. That's probably as a family what we really, really enjoy doing.
That's awesome. I've spent many a day in the wood with my family, and I think those are where some of the greatest memories are made.
Absolutely. Yes.
When I was a kid, I was like really not into hiking. I just remember as a child, my mom would take me on small hikes because she was really outdoorsy with my dad. And I remember being like, when is it going to end? Are we there yet? Are we there yet, Mom? But now that I live in the Pacific Northwest, I love hiking. I think it's such a great way just to decompress and, you know, get off your phone and see the outdoors. So I'm right there with you. I love the outdoors so much. So with that, and I was wondering, your son, John, went to school for aviation at University of North Dakota, or as most people know it as UND. How did his passion ignite in him, or when did you first notice his fascination with flight? And then also, why did he choose to go to school at UND?
Right. Well, with John, you know, from an early age, I'd say even when he was a toddler, he had a fascination with anything transportative. So it pretty much started with like matchbox cars and Thomas the Train, or trains in general. Kind of went up to our city transport system called the Chicago Transit Authority. So the CTA, we'd drive past there and if we're at a stoplight, he's just like staring at the trains, loved going on the trains. And for a long time it was trains. And he would ask, you know, how long does it take to be a train conductor? Can I drive these trains? I'm like, you're not old enough and you have to go to college first. And he'd repeatedly ask those questions. And then it kind of went up to, airplanes, so kind of wheels to wings, and that was probably around the age of 10. He got a gift from a good friend of his in elementary school to go for a plane ride out of Executive, which is a airport about a half hour from Chicago, just north of Chicago, and they would sell these rides where you could go either, you know, a few people, one or two people, and you get in the plane, the small plane, and they could take it at sunset or just early in the morning. And you could go down to the city skyline in Lake Michigan and fly around and come back. And his friend, Roberto, and he and John were classmates, and Roberto had a good fascination with aviation as well. And I think a lot of times they spoke a lot about planes, and then Roberto's family gave him this gift, a certificate, and he could invite one friend. So he invited John. So we've told Roberto that he really was the fuel to the fire for John, because I think it was after that flight that he came home, and he was just, it wasn't so much trains and trucks and cars anymore. It was all about aviation, and he started reading about different planes and what a great time it was. And he wanted to know if, you know, for his birthday, could he get that same gift? And I actually think we did, my husband Al, they did go together and went flying from that same place. And he just loved it.
I love that. It seems to be like, I don't know if it is super common, but it's funny. Both me and my brother had a fascination for trains growing up, and then it slowly evolved into aviation. And I've had one other flight instructor that was the same exact way. I remember like my first memories were literally just playing with Thomas the Train. That was like my favorite thing to do. First backpack was a Thomas the Train backpack. I was absolutely obsessed. My dad had made us like one of those, it was like a table where you could set up all the track, and it even had like the airport with the runway, the whole nine yards. Oh. It was so cool. But that's how it started for us. And I'm still fascinated by trains. Anything automotive, I think piques sort of that interest in me.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I think John, I forgot to stick in there. There was a period of time I wanted to be a truck driver. And then I knew, I was like, oh my God, he's going to be a truck driver. what the heck? And that would have been fine if that's really, really what he wanted to do. But that the aviation, you know, it just continued. We thought for a while when he was in middle school that it would evolve to something else, right? Because it had kind of made this transition from trains to the subway system to aviation. And then we thought, oh, it'll be something else by the time he gets to high school. And it never changed. It just became more aviation. Yeah.
He caught the bug.
Mm-hmm. Caught the bug. And then he was looking at, without really telling us, he was looking at the requirements for, you know, private pilot's license and what, you know, what age you could do that. And he had researched that all. So he already knew about that when he came to us about actually going back to that place executive and getting his private pilot's license.
So was there like a specific reason why he chose UND, or was it just kind of because of the proximity to home?
No, there are closer schools than that. It is from Chicago, about a 10-hour drive. He had looked this up, and he had felt it was the best school. Like he looked up, and this is the thing about John, when he kind of got into something, he read a lot about whatever that thing was, that topic, and he would know a lot about it. And so he had looked up different aviation programs. We looked at Western Michigan. We looked down in Southern Illinois, and, you know, he went to a high school in Chicago that it's called a selective enrollment high school, which is means that it's a really great high school. It's up on the north side of Chicago. And you have to test into these schools because there's a lot of schools in the city, but there's some that are really considered top tier, and to get into them, you have to test in. And so he got into this school, which was, you know, a great academic center, but there weren't any other people looking at aviation programs. They're all looking at like academic schools, like, you know, where can I go to become a engineer or a, you know, a doctor, or, you know, these places that so his guidance counselor, who is a nice guy, just couldn't really help John, because he's looking at this kid. And he's like, I don't know anything about aviation programs, which is what John expected. So he had already done a lot of the homework, and I think he gave that person more information in retrospect about aviation. And so UND, number of planes, like the ability to be flying early in the process, the reputation, and that's really what, and then he had looked at Embry-Riddle, but you know, he thought with Embry-Riddle, which is a great program, he felt like the cost was more, and he thought, if I'm going to end up with the same degree at the end of the day in commercial aviation, why would I pay more per year? You know, he's pretty frugal as well. So.
So I know, for real. I'm like, he was on top of it. And that's such a, it really is breaking through, you know, breaking the ceiling, breaking the glass to get into the door of aviation is really no easy feat. I mean, you're kind of learning a whole new language. I know I grew up within the industry, but after I lost my father, when I decided to go to flight school, I was absolutely clueless. I thought I knew something, and I really didn't. I had no clue what all you needed and what the requirements were. And so there was a lot of time just on my own researching that and doing the back end. So I admire that a lot.
Yeah. He had known a lot about the ins and outs, the requirements before we obviously did. I mean, we knew he was interested because when we started talking about schools, he was basically like, you know, mom and dad, I want to pursue this as a career, and this is what I'm looking at. And he was so serious. He had really, he had a maturity beyond his years. And if you had met him, you'd really be looking at him like, wait, how old are you? Because he really came off as a knowledgeable, you know, mature young adult. And that was true even in high school. And, you know, I think people always thought he was older than he was because he appeared that way. And he looked that way, but he also, his personality was like that. I remember one time he was going up north. He was a senior in high school and he was driving up north to visit or pick up his sister, Grace, to come home for the holidays. So he was driving up there with our car and some guy rear-ended him. It's probably before Thanksgiving or something like that. And the guy took off. And so John called the police and then he called me. And I came up with the other car and I'm driving up there and I'm just concerned, is he okay? And he sounded okay on the phone, but you know, so I get up there and it's just John and the police officers in the car, you know, in the police car. And I come out of the car and I walk over and one of the officers comes over to me. He goes, is this your son? Is this your son, John? And I said, yes, that's our son. He goes, my goodness, what a mature young man. He goes, I looked at his license and I can't believe he's 17 and a half. I said, I know. Yeah.
Well, you got to pat yourself on the back for that.
Yeah, I think that was just him. Like he just, that was his first, you know, how do you control that? But thanks for saying that. I think, you know, he had a maturity and that, you know, I think that helped him along the way. So yeah.
I think we definitely all have our own, you know, characteristics, but I do definitely believe that you are somewhat of a product of your environment. So whatever you put into that environment, he's definitely taken a lot out of it. So I definitely, well, that's you. Something to be very proud of. But yeah. I wanted to ask, you and your husband both practice medicine, correct?
Yes, we do. My husband, Al, is a,
oh
is
no, go a for
physician.
It.
Yeah. I was gonna say he's a physician. He's a physician scientist in infectious diseases.
Wow. You guys are both smart cookies. Oh my goodness. So did it ever, was the FAA stringent medical standards, was that ever something that was on your radar prior to your entire experience? And was that ever something John mentioned to you when he kind of started seeking out aviation?
That's a good question. The first question, no, we weren't aware of the, of anything in regard to the AME standards. Like we really don't, I mean, I have to say, looking back, we relied on John a lot because he had read through so many things. And if we had a question, we'd ask him and he'd be able to tell us whatever, you know, we had a question on in regard to aviation. So he saw an AME here in Chicago for his third class certificate before he left for school. And, you know, around the time he was getting his PPL, and he had looked up where one was in the city, and I helped make him the appointment for him, and he went in for it. And I remember that visit because I went with him. I waited out, you know, outside the car and took him the appointment, and everything went fine. And I said, you know, how was it? He goes, oh, he, you know, it wasn't too bad, Mom. He examined me and he checked my vitals and did this and everything. I'm healthy. And I think it's just, it's going to be fine. It was like paperwork, you know, they had to do. And I remember thinking, well, you know, he wears glasses. I was like, is that a big, I go, I know this is a stupid question, but like, can you wear glasses? And he goes, yeah, Mom, that's not a problem. And then my husband and I were talking later. Our main concern really was going into this field as physicians was, what if something happens to you? Like, this is your career. And let's just say out of the blue, you lose vision in one eye, or you get vertigo and you're so imbalanced. I had a patient like that who was a pilot. He was a helicopter pilot, but he got vertigo. He couldn't work. Mm-hmm. And you know, that we never figured out why, but he couldn't fly anymore. And, you know, the things I see it in my practice all the time, things happen to people without good reason and without, you know, suddenly, right? So I know he's a healthy young individual, a young person, but things happen. And so I think for us, it was like, you're kind of putting all your eggs in one basket. Like, what if something happens? And so we were encouraging him before he went to college to think about a secondary degree like business or even law or just something else he could fall back on should something happen. And that's really the only degree of concern we had with the medical.
And so John didn't ever like mention any of his concerns though, like that he had any concerning his medical.
Concerning about his medical?
Yeah, like, did he have any concerns? Like, or was he just like the same? Like, he didn't really realize like how intense the air medical system is.
He didn't express that to us. Whether he, I mean, looking back now, it's possible he had those kind of thoughts about the whole system. I'm sure in regard, you know, toward the end of his life of what happened, he was probably very aware. Yeah. But he never shared that with us. I don't know if I told you this before, maybe I did, but his spring of freshman year when he was home on break, he mentioned your podcast to us. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure he was aware because he had told us about it. He didn't mention the podcast. He mentioned the petition. Mm-hmm. He shared it with us by text that he was talking about it after dinner one night. And he said, you know, this is something that's really important and we have to think about this, and you know, if you read it, you should think about signing it. And he brought it up on his phone and then he shared it with Al and I. Right. And I think about that now, and I've talked to Al, and I've talked to my husband about it, and I really honestly have thought about this so many times. I don't think it was in regard to his own, you know, mental health concerns at that time. I think somehow he was, you know, he read on his phone a lot. So you guys caught it. The petition caught his eye.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful that he signed that and actually shared that with you. So he was kind of an advocate himself in a way.
If you look back, it'll be interesting to see if he signed or if he.
I did end up finding, I remember Anne, when you had reached out to me, you telling me that, and it, I went on a whole rabbit chase, and I sorted through, I think at that point, I think it was around 7,000 or 9,000 signatures, but I found his name. And that was, that was an extremely powerful moment for me.
That's incredible.
I remember that's just one of those moments you really don't ever forget.
Yeah. What is the signature count at now?
We're
at like 11,700, I think. So almost 12,000. Yeah. It's really skyrockets when obviously when someone passes away. Which is why we're always saying, you know, sign the petition even when there isn't a tragedy, like it still needs to be done. So
it's still
going strong. And we're hoping that that is an endorsement of our message for air medical reform. So that's a reason to sign it.
Yeah.
But I did want to ask you, Anne, because one of the conversations that we had after John's passing was that you had been in contact with his friends at UND, and yes, one of the students that you had spoken with, which was one of John's good friends, was really struggling after he passed, and he wanted to seek help, but his dad was a pilot, airline pilot, and was telling him not to. And it was really kind of a struggle for you, because that's exactly what you're fighting for, is you want these kids to get the help that they need, because it's not more important to fly. You know, it's more important to take care of yourself and then fly. So I guess my question was, how does it make you feel? And what do you want those who feel they need help but have been discouraged not to get help to know?
It's upsetting. It was so emotional when I saw this person in front of me, this young person just struggling and not doing well emotionally. I mean, John had just passed away. It was within the week. And he said, you know, I made an appointment to talk to someone, you know, next week. I talked to my, you know, it's a father. And he said, don't do that. Don't do that. And that's going to be on your record the rest of your career. And I don't think that's unusual. I mean, the students would know better, but this is my feeling. Like another parent who was a friend, their child was a friend of John's at UND. He's a pilot. He's a, you know, high up in one of the commercial airlines. And he said, this is an industry-wide problem.
Yeah.
This is the first words out of his mouth when he saw Al and I, this is an industry-wide problem. And, you know, I remember thinking then, wow, well, we had no idea that was an issue. And I think that's hearing it from someone, like if I'm in medicine and I'm saying to someone who's not in medicine, yeah, this is a big problem within our profession, it means something, because this person is like, he's worked for decades in this career, in his career. So he knows what he's talking about. And that's when I think Al and I looked at each other and we're like, what the heck is going on here? You know, like what can be done? What can be done to make this better?
So do you have any follow-up on that student? Did he ever go and seek care, or is he still?
Yeah, it took like, stigma? It was like probably 3 or 4 times
before
he could go.
Okay. Because I know now UND has a lot of services. Like they're really the forefront runner, I guess, in aviation mental health, or so it seems. So I'm thinking, obviously they may now have something where the students don't even have to disclose that they've gotten counsel or help.
Yes. I think they are, you know, that's part of, and we can talk about it now, we can talk about it later, but with the initiative fund, John's name, the John A. Hauser, initiative fund in mental health and aviation, the benefit of what's happening now is for the future aviation students and current aviation students, that there will not be a major barrier to seek help for any kind of mental health issue. Be it, as I said, when I was at the first summit on mental health and aviation, it's, you know, these young people, my goodness, I mean, coming through a pandemic, John was a senior when the pandemic started. He was a senior in high school. Your life just suddenly stops. Right? It's hard on everyone, but I can only imagine how hard it is on young adults going through high school and college at that time, or any grade. And we know, I mean, there's a CDC report that just came out recently. It's incredibly high number of, I think 1 in 3 reported teenagers between 14 and 19 reported symptoms of depression or anxiety on a 100+ questionnaire. And that 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 or 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 expressed suicidal ideation during the pandemic. And, you know, this is a whole group of, you know, millions of young adults that are going to become adults. And to think that's not going to affect any career much, you know, aviation, of course, medical, yes, nursing, absolutely. These are all things I think that we're all going to have to look at with people coming up the ranks and getting into these careers. And I think the difference here in aviation is it's not really being addressed in a way that's healthy. And kind of where we stand, my husband and I is, and I work in primary care, you know, we actually like to treat these things. We like to actually
identify what the problem, you know, is, diagnose something, and actually treat them and get them better. Because the majority of time, that's exactly what we do. And that can be from counseling, counseling alone, counseling with medication. And in severe cases, sometimes, yeah, hospitalization, if that's needed. But to not address or be actively told by someone in the profession, maybe a mentor, don't do that. Don't make that appointment with the therapist or counselor. Wow, that just is so, to me, in my career, in my profession, is so backwards. I don't understand it. And no one's going to get better with that kind of an app, right? I think the first thing they're learning as students is, how do I hide what I'm feeling so I can get around it somehow? And I just feel like, especially given what we've gone through this year, you can't hide that. There's no getting around your emotions and how you're feeling. You have to really healthily address it. And the best way to address it is, in my opinion, would be talking to somebody who knows that field. And what UND is doing, to their credit, is they are trying to and working toward a system where it can be anonymous and nothing's reportable, given, you know, whatever level of, right, whatever the condition is, it has to be, you know, something not severe, right? If someone was thinking of hurting themselves or taking their life, that would not, they need help. But, you know, there are a majority of cases, it's less than that. If you just broke up with a girlfriend or boyfriend, if your parents are getting divorced, if you just lost a grandparent, if someone's been in the hospital and you're just stressed out, and that might lead to anxiety or feeling down, it's okay, you know, to talk to someone. That's what you should do. And I feel like they're just going into this in the beginning, in really the early stages of their career, and they're being told, and they're being counseled not to do that. So I think Al and I and Grace and our family really feels like our emphasis is really in the student end of things. Like, we really want students to say to themselves, hey, check in with yourself. How am I feeling? And if I'm not really feeling that great, you know, what are my options and what can I do?
I appreciate you reiterating that message, because I feel like, especially within this community, it's a message that I feel like we cannot emphasize, nor can we repeat enough, because just like you said, there are hundreds of kids being told that message that they can't go seek help because it's going to negatively impact their career. And it does, it breeds a very deep set stigma. And that in itself is almost an illness. It makes you feel like, well, if you do feel bad, why can't you just feel better? You know what I mean? You're hinging everything off of this emotion, and it does weigh on people heavily. But I kind of wanted to talk about your family for a second, because I know that after John's passing, there has been kind of a major spotlight on you and your family and John's story. Yeah. So what has that been like for you and your family, and what tools have helped you the most in processing your grief?
Honestly, you know, Emma and Maddie, it's been a little overwhelming, especially, well, it's just, first of all, you know, the local, our neighbors, our family members, which are great. They're so loving and so caring, and they were there on the ground immediately. But then it's these other levels of, you know, attention that, you know, people we don't know reaching out to us. There were people that came to John's memorial that are in the aviation industry, didn't know us, didn't know John, but heard the story, and they just had to come. Made us cry so much. You know, literally pilots for United that came to John's memorial and stood in line and waited, you know, to talk to us. And, you know, that just is so, you realize then, like, oh, wow, this is something, I don't realize how many people know about this. And then you have news stations calling, and there was a news reporter from North Dakota. His name escapes me right now, but he's very kind. And he reached out to the university, then reached out to us and wanted to do a story on John. And he did. And then a local Chicago news affiliate out of Stefan Holt, who's a newscaster for Chicago. He's a pilot. He loves to fly recreationally. And he had heard John's story from
the news, and he wanted to talk to us. And, you know, I think initially our immediate reaction was, we don't think we can do this. Like, it's too soon and it's too painful. And it's just hard. It's hard to talk about it. It's hard to talk about it with people that we don't know and didn't know John. But then when we thought about it a while, we realized, you know, this is why we have to do it, because it has gained attention, and this is a topic that isn't talked about, and there's stigma, and we can wallow in our grief, which is painful enough, or we can try to take energy from that grief and we can try to change things. And my husband and I, at the end of the day, that's what we decided, that was more important, it's painful, but it'll be worse if nothing changes.
I think that you guys are really just such huge pillars of strength. Like, it takes a lot for someone to go and be an advocate after they've lost their son. And I just want to tell you that I think that you're amazing.
Thank
and
you.
I know like nothing that I can say can really, you know, help your grieving process, but it has been really, truly like such an honor to be able to just speak with you and speak about John and share his story, because I know it's really helping people. And there has been such an explosion of advocacy and work done because of John.
Thank you. We hope so. But I, you know, getting back to the students again, I feel like, you know, we didn't know John was struggling. He had no prior history of any kind of a mental health diagnosis, depression, anxiety at all. And that's what makes us feel that, I mean, it's kind of a frightening thing to think about, but there's probably more people out there like that, students. And like I just said about the back shadow of the pandemic and what, you know, maybe they've lost people in their family from COVID. Maybe their family's struggling financially because of COVID. Maybe they have a lot of financial pressure, you know, all these things. And I really feel like John was probably not alone. Like there's probably other people out there, and maybe they're commercial pilots, or maybe they're working pilots, right? And they've been furloughed and now they're back to work in such demand that they have, you know, they're asking me to do overtime. I mean, it's a hard profession. It's one thing I step back and I go, this is just hard life.
And like, I think you mentioning like it's a lot of young people that are suffering with this, and they're coming up and becoming adults. All these young people are now becoming commercial airline pilots. I mean, my husband is only 34 years old. He just flew with a 25-year-old first officer. So all of these kids coming up, not being able to get mental health, but are very aware of their mental health, are becoming in charge of planes, big planes, and they deserve that help. And they need that
help
because they are being put through one of the hardest times in aviation. I believe the pilot shortage is the greatest it's ever been. And that is a lot of stress to have on your shoulders. So
we traveled well, and I hope your husband's doing well, and he, you know, younger pilots probably look up to him, right? So it's this thing where I see it in medicine too, where you're asked to do a lot, and you're asked to work long hours and do things under duress and stress and under little sleep, and people's lives are in your hands. And at the very least, what we can do for these people is support their mental health. You're asking so much of them. The only time we flew this summer, we went out to Maine, and our flight was slightly delayed because there was no pilot. And so they were waiting. And literally, I don't know, an hour later, we see these two people running to our gate.
Oh, wow.
And my first concern is like, are they okay?
Yeah.
Like, what, you know, these poor people, they're running gate to gate. You're furloughed and now you can't get, you know, you don't get a break. You're just going, which isn't, it's the nature of probably the beast with this profession, but I think it's hard. And you're right. And young people coming up, I think there's this other thing about aviation students and this need, like you're putting a lot of money into this profession as in the education process. It costs money. I mean, John was aware of that, how much everything costs. And there's a lot riding on that from the very beginning. If you're taking out loans to cover your student tuition and things like that, if you're not going to an aviation school, but you're doing it on the side, that's also obviously it's still cost the same. Airtime's expensive. Flying with a CFI is expensive. And then there's pressure to pass these exams and check rides. We learned that a lot from John too. Like he would tell us when he was up for check rides and things like that. And, you know, so there's a lot riding on their ability to get through these steps. And then there's this need on the other end, like hurry up and get over here because we need you. And mm-hmm. I know with John, he was a year ahead with his program. He worked really hard and I'm sure everybody does, but he worked hard to stay on track with his classes and stuff. And he was working outside of school too to earn extra money. And I think behind that all, he knew there was this need to get pilots out there. I mean, if you look left and right, there's like new program, there's new aviation schools that are opening up everywhere you look, like United has their own. And I read something the other day about Mesa Airlines, and there's just this. So I think it's almost a little bit dangerous that, you know, it's like this tube of toothpaste. You're pushing really hard at one end to squeeze out all this end product, right? But you're not really looking at the process in between about how that's working.
Yeah, the quality control is not there.
The quality control, and how are they doing?
Yeah, how are they actually doing? Yeah, I think that's important to note. So my next question is kind of to talk about John and the memory of him. So like one of my favorite quotes that I've always loved is memories are the June flowers and the Decembers of our lives. Mm. And I really think that. Like we were just talking to Tessa Daniel, Chris Daniel's wife earlier mm-hmm. today, and we were talking about memories about her husband. I just was telling her, I was like, you know, those are when my dad passed away. Those are the things that really helped me was talking about his memory. And I actually got to go back and work with his coworkers at the airport he had been working at. So that really helped me in my grieving process. But I wanted to ask you what was John like outside of aviation? What were his hobbies? What did he excel in? And kind of what you already said, he was very serious and his personality, but
he had a completely funny, silly side. When he was younger, a good friend of mine reminded me of this. He would just love to laugh. I mean, he would tell jokes, and she goes, remember that time we were at the kitchen table? He was trying to get the joke out. He probably was like 5 or 6 maybe. And he was talking this, like probably some silly joke about something. And we all knew the punchline because we'd heard the joke before. And he's trying to get it out and he's laughing so hard. He slaps his hand against the table, like repeatedly, like, cause he's laughing. He's having a big belly laugh. He's slapping the table and he can't get it out. And so we're all laughing really hard at just the image of him trying to get this stupid punchline out that we all know what it is. And he's laughing so hard. He can't get it out. And he starts slapping the table. Like, you know, it's so funny. He liked good laugh. He definitely had a healthy dose of sarcasm. He would say stuff that's, you know, be sarcastic about something, but in a very funny way. And that was, and you know, I think as he got older, that became part of his sense of humor. He's very loud. One of his friends, Dylan, who liked to fly, he's a pilot as well. Friends, they rode together in Chicago with a group called Chicago Rowing Foundation. It's a really great program for young people here. And many of them actually in the boat that John was on, majority of the boys in his boat went on to row in college. And John could have had that. He had that option. He decided, you know, he wanted to go into aviation. So he stopped after high school, but he was so loud. And if he weren't 6'3", you know, 170 pounds, 6'3" guy, he probably would have been a good coxswain, because the coxswains are the ones that are like,
that yell the orders.
Yeah, they give the orders at the front of the boat, and they're like 4'11" and like 100 pounds soaking wet. But they have the loudest voice. Whereas John would, you know, it was kind of a mixed blessing, because when he was in school, his voice carried. And so if there was some shenanigan going on in the classroom, the teacher heard John's voice. So it was not unusual that John got pegged for some things that he probably didn't do, but his voice would carry so loud that he would get called, you know, which he thought was a big injustice. he was, I will say seriously, things that were unjust to him bothered him a lot. He had a huge heart. And, you know, things got under his skin when he thought things weren't right. And he would think upon those things a lot. And he was very empathetic and compassionate. And I don't know, that I'm pretty sure you cannot teach someone. I think they have that sense, or they don't. But John had it like 11 out of 10. And I think that was hard. You know, I think that in the end, there were things bothering him that he couldn't share.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing with suicide. You don't, will not know. We will not know everything. But things, because of that big heart, things, you know, he absorbed a lot of things that I think started to affect him. And, you know, that's the one thing I wish he had reached out. And it, of course, we wish he could still be here today, because he had talked to someone about how he was feeling. But where he stayed, where the house he was in before, his apartment before he died, it was a really nice family we got to know, and the mom was visiting a few times when John was there, and she's a psychologist. And she, when we came to the house to collect John's things, one of the first things she said to us was, "I know I'm just meeting you. I just want you to know I work as a clinical psychologist. I've interacted with John quite a few times in the last month, and I'm blown away. I had no idea." And I think, you know, in a way, as a parent, that helped us, because as a parent, all you want to do is help your children and protect them and make sure they're, hopefully they're happy. And we just felt like we missed it, and we still do. I mean, there's a certain part of us that will never be okay with what happened.
Yeah.
Because that's our child.
I've always said there are some elements to grief that are kind of like a little bit of a hole in your heart, and they, you know, you can work through grief, but there's always, like I said, there's just going to be an element to it that you might not ever be able to fill that hole. You just learn how to grow around it. And I always tell people, whether it sounds ignorant or not, you know, eventually you'll be able to learn how to plant flowers and make something good of it. And I think you and your family have done an incredible job at that, making some good come from such a terrible, tragic situation. And it always, yeah, it always hurts to talk to people who have, you know, lost someone. It feels like there is a little bit of a similarity where, you know, the people who are here, the people that they leave behind, we tend to beat ourselves up over it. Like, what could we have done, you know, to prevent this? What could we have done? I'm so sorry for your loss, Anne. And I know Maddie said it, but I want to reiterate it. I just admire you and your family's strength, because this is really no easy feat.
Yeah. Thank you, Emma. It's not easy. I don't wish that any family should go through this, which is why we really want to enact change and make it a better situation, you know, definitely for aviation students and young pilots and working pilots and even, you know, flight attendants. Even, I mean, people that are under the same rules. And I don't think we can feel good about anything and without doing what we're doing. Because, yeah, you know, that's how we honor John.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And speaking of honoring him and in the remembrance of John and to, you know, further the work of mental health and aviation, you and your family started the John A. Hauser Initiative Fund. So we had spoke about that a little bit, but I just wanted you to talk again about the mission of the fund and what has been done with the fund thus far.
Right. So we started this fund in the days following John's passing, his death, and it was a hard thing to do because you're grieving and you're in shock and we're trying to figure out, you know, how to make some sense out of this tragedy. And so we did partner with UND to start this initiative fund in John's name. And what it does is a couple of things. Our goal is to help support aviation students at UND by helping to remove stigma around mental health, first of all, education. So bringing in speakers throughout the year to talk about the importance of mental health care and how we self-care, what is anxiety, you know, what is depression, what does that look like? And then really bringing in professionals who maybe have experienced this in their career and how they've maybe navigated through that and come out, you know, doing well. I think of Colin, you know, who the speaker you've had on and what he's been through. And those are the kind of speakers we're hoping to get in touch with the students instead of the things they're hearing through the pipeline, like don't do that and don't come forward and don't talk to someone, is having people there that are in the profession as well and have done that and have been helped by it. There were also looking to hire an embedded psychologist who has education in therapy, in treating mental health, you know, healthcare problems, conditions, but also has understanding of the FAA regulations and, you know, kind of one foot in each area so that they can help students feel supported so that when they do come forward that, you know, there's a lot of things that can be handled without it being reportable. Right. So that this person would understand that is a hard one because it's just, there's a shortage in that area of profession. And in North Dakota, they're already stretched thin, but I know they've been interviewing someone for that position. We've been told. And then the other thing is a program that's called Uplift. And it's the first in the country on the university campus of a peer support program for student to student. So that's in the making. I know that the woman who is the assistant dean in the aviation program has been working with, I want to say it's a United Kingdom program that uses this for their embedded program for their pilots since German Wings. So this is mandated, I believe, for all of the airlines in Europe. But anyway, they're using it, a system based like that for aviation students so that it could be through texting or web-based 24/7 access to speak to, you know, someone in this case, it would be another student. But, you know, I do think with young people, their group is their peer group. Yeah. So if they're going to be influenced by something, you know, a parent could say something or a coach might say something, but you know, when a junior says something to a freshman or a senior says something to a sophomore, there might be more attention paid to that. And that's what we're hoping. So that's something that's starting. And these are all things that have been funded by John's fund. And then the other thing is this National Summit on Aviation and Mental Health, the first of its kind, and happened in December of 2021 in Chicago. And that brought together a lot of the major airlines, commercial airlines, Air Force, military, and some representatives of the FAA were there to come together and talk about the approach to mental health in aviation. And that was an all-day thing. This year, it's going to be held in November at UND. It's going to be 2 days. They have a lot of speakers lined up. There's going to be, you know, some breakout sessions. That is something, and really, I think the thing that I remember from last year, because quite honestly, we went to that, my husband and I, we were still in shock, but Billy Hoffman, Dr. Hoffman, I really think and feel very strongly that he is going to be this, and already is, this up up and coming force about, you know, looking into the research behind pilots' attitude toward healthcare in general, in mental health care too, but just healthcare in general, and seeking health care support. And his research is looking into, you know, the hesitancy of pilots to seek medical care. I know you know him well. You've had him on, I'm sure. Yeah. He's a great speaker. He's a great speaker. And we just learned so much listening to him.
We absolutely love Billy.
Yeah, he's our goat.
We superhero. Yeah.
Yeah.
The greatest of all time.
And like, I think one of the sentences he said really has stuck out to me. And I guess this is something I think about a lot. And he said, you know, this problem in aviation, this is not a pilot problem. This is a systems problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
System is not right. And so it's forcing pilots to make decisions about what they're going to do in a not supportive manner, in a not unsupported manner. And really, in my opinion, as a doctor, an unhealthy manner.
Yeah,
you know, and I think his research, and, you know, to the credit of the FAA, they are funding his research, and I'm sure he's getting it from other areas, but I really hope he continues to work in this area. I think that's another area of once we understand better why pilots, and I think we know to a certain extent why they hesitate to come forward, but if there's things we can do to work to help that, right? Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the coin, to help the limitations that the FAA has put forward with their air medical standards. I think between those two sides, I think we'll get somewhere.
Definitely. I think Billy's research is super important because that is what the FAA wants, is his research, his data, so that they can have that to fall on for liability purposes.
All that quantitative evidence.
Hard at. Yeah, qualitative.
Yeah, studies, evidence. But, yeah, the scientific
the evidence. Because we know that there's a problem, but now we just have to prove it through those research studies that the problem exists. Even though we know it's there, we have to prove that it is. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, awesome, and he says too, and I agree, like most pilots, they want to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want to break any rules or break laws. They want to do the right thing. It's just the system as it is an untenable situation where it makes them, it really kind of forces their hand, and we can do better than that.
Yes, we can. So that kind of leads me to my next question, Anne, because together you and I have been pushing for change on the congressional side. So I just wanted to talk to you about that. And what are some of the avenues you've taken to speak to Congress on these issues?
Right. So a large part about what we have done, my husband and I, other than trying to raise awareness, which is, you know, I look at a lot of the support from the newscasts as things that are going to, a lot of people we know have come up to us and like, we had no idea, like this was an issue in AV, like literally, like very, very well-educated people like coming up, like we didn't know this was a problem. So that's part, right? The other is reaching out to our local politicians. I live in Illinois. We had reached out shortly after John died to Senator Tammy Duckworth, kind of unsuccessfully. I mean, her response was not too uplifting. It was basically she would kind of look into it, and we never heard back from her. We've written letters and sent emails to Secretary Buttigieg about, and he sits, you know, in the transportation. Secretary of Transportation, he's quite busy, of course, but we wanted to, you know, make him aware of what our concerns were and the loss of our son and where things are. I've got to believe it's come across someone in that office's desk. We wrote a hard copy letter and we've emailed, and that was a few months ago. There's a congressman that in our state named Mike Boast. He sits on the House Committee of Transportation Infrastructure. I've messaged him, I've written him a letter, I've emailed his office, and also sent letters to Senator Pete DeFazio, who's on that same committee. Sean Kasten is a congressman in Illinois. He doesn't sit on this committee, but he gave us a meeting with one of his aides, and we did speak with her. So And that was around the holidays.
Was his assistant, like, was she receptive to the message?
She was. She actually was a nurse by training.
Oh, good.
And so a lot of the things we were talking about in the medical area, she understood. I personally think there is some urgency here, right? People's lives are literally at stake, and we'd like this to move so quickly. But, you know, in talking with federal agencies, and my comparison is working for the VA system, when we were residents in training and worked at VA hospitals, things just move at a snail's pace. Yeah. And it's frustrating, right? Yeah. But I do believe, at least I really want to believe, our voices are being heard, and forming, as you have done, Maddie, so skillfully, is getting stakeholders involved in this. And, you know, sadly, our family isn't alone in losing a loved one in this way, who's a pilot. Like, the more we collectively use our voices, I believe, I really have to believe that change is going to come.
Definitely. It just is like death by a thousand needles. Just keep poking the bear, and then hopefully they answer back. Like, I will wait it out as long as I can until somebody does something. And
yeah.
I know it's going to take a long time, but that kind of helps me. Is like, Maddie, you just have to be patient. Like, the government never does anything fast.
And I think there's the difference. Like, I look at the university side of things, where they've already enacted a few, you know, some things, and we're talking about, you know, into the future, what other things can we do? And it is to serve as an example for other aviation programs in the country. But federal agency, it's just more layers and bureaucracy. And that's a feeling I got when we were at the summit too. First they had to have to admit there is an issue or problem, and then they'd have to commit to doing something about the problem. I look at the funding of Dr. Hoffman's research as at least something in a positive direction. At least they're saying, hey, okay, we're interested in seeing what comes of this research and what the results are.
Yeah. It's a slight acknowledgement of what is happening.
Yes. But yeah, we all would like it to be, you know, I feel like we're hitting the doorbell on their front door. We're just hitting the doorbell and hitting the doorbell, and no one's answering right now. But
yeah,
they're home. We have to be patient.
Yes, we do.
I just
wanted to tell you, Anne, too, that you know, in all the conversations I've had, like, John's story is always mentioned. So I know that people know that this is an issue, and John's story is kind of like leading the way. Yeah, it's interesting because they won't always mention his name, which I'm always like, we should be mentioning John's name, but they will tell his story. And I think that that's important. Like, a lot of people know John's story, even though they're not talking directly to us. At least his story is being shared all around in aviation communities.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I think it, like I said in the beginning, his story has had a huge butterfly effect within this community. If you don't know his story, it's like, hit the door. I mean, it really has, I think, you know, had this extremely powerful impact. Especially I've seen it within some of the older generation. I think there is starting to become a lot more understanding and acceptance to how big and how important this problem is. And kind of going back to the congressional side, I see what Maddie deals with every single day, and I can't imagine how disheartening it is. And it's disheartening for me. You know, I would love to be able to be in contact. I know in the beginning I was petitioning Sam Graves, and I don't know how many messages that man has received from me, and I haven't, nothing, zero acknowledgement. And that can be really, really frustrating. But one thing that has always kind of given me hope, and given me hope for you and Maddie and just everyone who's been affected by this, is that I'm hoping that with the future and with every year that goes by, I think we are becoming more and more progressive as a country. And eventually, in 20, 30, 40 years from now, and it sucks to have those kind of numbers, but eventually there will be a whole new generation of people who are looking at these kind of things. And I can only hope that it's only going to get better. And I just try and tell myself that to, you know, just stay hopeful. But I do feel like change is on the horizon. And I do think that a huge part of that is because of John's story.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think a large part is what you guys have started. Like I said, John shared that petition with us. So I know it had already hit his radar. And, you know, with any issue, the first issue is talking about it, right? Getting it out, having people understand the problem, and then we work on a solution. And we need that support of this federal agency to do that. But the thing we've been using with John is his initials, JAH, so Joy and Hope. And his rowing team has taken that into under their wings too. And they have made like bracelets and some pins at his funeral. And, you know, Joy, for the joyful human being he was, which I wish he had known him. He really had a lot of joy, especially for flying. And there were a lot of things before that, but it became flying. And hope that, like you're both saying, it's hope that we can see change happen and that we can see change within this industry, because there needs to be.
Yeah, yeah. And thank you again, Anne, just for coming on again. I feel like I'm beating a dead horse, but I really do think that the courage, the strength is just something to really, really admire. And I've said it a lot of times on this show, but there is a stigma about suicide, not just within the aviation industry, but just within a lot of cultures, within a lot of communities in America. Yes. And there are people who really don't want to accept this. And so for you as a parent, and you and your family to take this and really, really make great change out of something so tragic is just, it is very beautiful and something that I have endless admiration for.
Thank you for saying that. We do it to honor John. And in his letter, one letter that he wrote to his sister, he asked that we work on this kind of a formative change. So, you know, we do it for him and we do it to honor him. But I would say we do it to honor all of these people that, you know, have died in their efforts of trying to do the best they could and trying to, you know, live their life, but not getting the support that they needed. And we really, really want to help people out there that they know there are other options and that they know, you know, this is okay. And the young people particularly, like, this is okay. It's okay if you don't feel great. It's okay if your emotional health is suffering. This is, in our time in history, this is probably the most common time it's going to happen. And probably the hardest thing to do is ask for that help. But what a brave thing to do too. And, you know, that's how things are going to get better, is this stigma removal. And you've said this before, both of you said it, like, I think this younger generation coming up is more open about talking about mental health. And I think that gives me hope, you know. And I know culturally, within cultures, this is stuff that isn't talked about, but gosh, there's a lot at risk if we don't talk about it, you know, people's lives. Yeah. So I, this is a great forum for that. And I'm so thankful, you know, to meet you both in terms of what you guys are doing. I know you have your own stories, but I kind of look at it as like I'm entering a room. Elle and I have talked about this. We go into a room of this grief of what's just happened to us. And you look back and you think, oh, that door will shut and no one else is going to come into this room. And, you know, there's other stories. You've had them on your show. It's, you don't want anyone walking through that door of what we've experienced. They don't want anyone else to enter into this experience of grief. And that's why, that's where we find our strength. And again, I look at his honoring John, and, you know, I know he would have been a great career pilot because he already was. He already was a great pilot.
I look at pictures of him and you can, there is a charisma that like comes through the screen. I know I never knew him, but through listening to you talk about him and everything that Maddie and I have learned, I feel like there is a part of me that I feel like I have to pay tribute to him. It feels like having a long lost brother or something. He just seemed like a beautiful and incredible soul. And I am so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Yeah. I feel like it's just such a shame. And it was just the beginning of his career, you know. That's why I think it's so important, you know, for the students, the young people, just take heed of how you're feeling and your health and processes, just take care of yourself. And it's the most important thing, yeah. You know, as you guys have said, it's like aviation, being a pilot is what you do, but you're a whole person, and taking care of that is self-care is so important in any field you go into, but particularly this one.
Yeah. So before we end the show today, I just wanted to ask you, you know, what can our audience do to further the work that you've done? And what would you like our community to remember about John? And how can we honor his memory?
I thought I would get a fun question at the end.
Ask Maddie about that.
Well, I really think, because John, first of all, I think if you're studying to be a pilot, is work hard at that. I think John took things seriously, but things he was very interested in, he took seriously and he did well. And I think that's really a model for, I think about it when I do my job, like how hard John worked for what he did, and he did it well. And so each day I challenge myself to do it the best that I can do. And that's a gift from John. Sign the petition if people haven't. That's something that people can do. And really, I think it's checking in on each other. And you know, so many people and young people that we saw at John's memorial and funeral, high school friends, some college friends, they felt bad because they didn't know John was, you know, struggling. And I think it takes little to make that call or send that text, check in. I think that's so important these days, again, in light of the pandemic and other things that are happening in our world. And, you know, it was interesting. There are a lot of other kids who also came up to us. We didn't know very well. And some live in Chicago and some lived out of state. And they would say something that John said to them, like a year ago or 2 years ago, or when they were struggling, their parents were getting divorced, whatever. And John was there and just said some things and just adds perspective to a situation, right? Whenever we think something is so terrible and dire, to hear someone else say, hey, you know, I'm concerned about you, or how are you doing? And, you know, my parents went through that and it's going to be okay. You know, just hearing, I think that's something that we all can do. It's just, you know, check in and then, you know, just try to be a good friend.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. Was going to ask you what beauty product you can't live without.
Emma, you would.
Well, you, but I need to know now. I need to know.
I have to go with a facial moisturizer. What do I use?
Yeah, what do you use?
There's something called Elta MD. It's a sunscreen and moisturizer. Ooh. And I've learned too with pilots, you guys have a higher risk of skin cancer. You should be using sunscreen. But I use that, and I use it religiously now. There's a dermatologist in our group, and so he always talks about sunscreen. But it's actually a really good moisturizer, so I use that. But I do like lip gloss. I like
lip balm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've been applying lip balm this whole time, just so you know. A little, I really like Carmex. It's so nice. So that's
well, what I've been using. I would probably buy anything you guys use because you're both so beautiful. If I could use one of those things, it would help me out. I would use it.
It's only because we're young, Anne.
No, you're beautiful on the inside and the outside.
Oh,
thank you.
And you're our favorite person ever.
No, I speak the truth. And I think the other thing is it's just great to have this forum for aviators and young people in particular. You know, who's talking about this right now? Really? You guys are.
Yeah.
So don't underestimate what an impact you guys are having. I think that's so important.
Thank you, Anne. That's so sweet.
Thank you so much, Anne. And I hope, you know, we'll be able to reconvene again, and hopefully this won't be the last time, you know, we have you on the podcast. I'd love to keep in touch and be able to inform everyone about how John's initiative is going. Because like we've said, this, you know, when Maddie and I started up the podcast again, it was only, gosh, Lord knows, it was about 2 months before John passed. And we watched a lot of our listeners are from Grand Forks and from UND. So I know this episode is very, very special to us, but I know it will be incredibly special to a large amount of our audience, if not all.
I'm glad. I know, you know, John had some good, very good experiences there, and he flew a lot. And yeah. It's kind of bittersweet, and it's a good program. It's a great program. So I hope if people are listening and they're thinking about aviation, we live near O'Hare, and so we have the flight line into O'Hare. There's always two planes every couple of minutes. We see them coming into the airport, and I remember I used to think, you know, one day that'll be John up there flying a plane. And now I look up and I cry sometimes, but it makes me feel good because it makes me feel connected to John. He just loved planes. Yeah. So hopefully, you know, we'll reconvene and talk about some progress.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
Some change for sure. Yes.
Change. Yes.
Again, thank you so much, Anne, for joining us today. Everyone, that is it for this week's episode. We will be, I don't know how it's going to work out, but this might be a one part, but it might be a two part series. So stay tuned. We'll be talking to two more people who were very closely affiliated to John, and I'm excited to speak to them. But Anne, thank you so much again for
Absolutely.
Coming on the show and just having the courage to speak to us today. We admire you big time.
Thanks, Em and Maddie.